Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
The program's going to be called, I think, Just Not Good Enough, which is the title of my book, which I've written.
Great.
Yeah, I haven't got it published yet, but that's another story. But it was partly written because it was therapy for me, actually, apart from anything else. But so the book's called that. That's a working title. I mean, does that resonate with you at all, that Just Not Good Enough?
Well, I think there's definitely a lot of... So I think it's really interesting, right? Because this is where I think the social media narrative around kind of business has been really unhelpful, because there's a lot of people who are kind of, you know, held out as business gurus and all this because they seem to have all the answers and you know, they give all this kind of pseudo philosophical advice on Instagram or whatever.
Sorry, Eli. It's a good job we're on FUBAR where you can say anything you like. So
and the challenge is, it makes people feel as if they should know and have all the answers and be able to kind of do that. And the reality is, whatever business you're in, you know, every day has uncertainty and every day has new challenges, and you don't often have all the answers, and so you do feel a bit kind of imposter syndrome.
Yeah,
and that's okay, because you know, if you feel imposter syndrome, that just means that's cool. Go find out. You know, go do your research, and that's a really healthy way, I think, to look at it versus the sort of, you know, the narrative of needing to know everything. Because if you think you need to know everything and then you don't know everything, you will feel that you're not good enough.
Yeah, I don't now because I'm retired, but I sat in business meetings thinking, shit, I should have thought of that. I should have said that. And now I still think that, actually, but I rationalize it by saying to myself, no, you know, other people have got good ideas. You don't have to have all of the ideas. Allow other people to flourish. And so I'm sort of dealing with it in that way, but it's still there at the back of my mind.
Yeah. But it also, I guess, comes down to what your scorecard is, right? Like, if your scorecard is, for argument's sake, wealth, like money in the bank, and if you don't have as much money in the bank as you think you ought to, you will feel, oh, I'm not good enough. Or if your scorecard is Instagram followers, or, you know, there's so many different scorecards people have. And I think you've got to evaluate in a situation where you do feel and have that sensation of not being good enough. I think you've got to almost review your scorecards to see if they're healthy.
Yeah.
To see if they're real.
I wish I'd spoken to you about 15 years ago, actually, because in my scorecard was, you know, I've come up through the finance ranks. It's very macho. It's very competitive. You know, it's the first function in the morning and the last function out. And then in the finance team, you had to be the first person in the morning and the last person out. So you just put stress on yourself by trying to be the best. And that ambition just gets in the way, frankly, particularly in terms of mental health. So it's quite interesting about your scorecard. I've never thought of it like that before.
I think it is really important that people don't think about it often enough, because, you know, the majority of business owners aren't super wealthy. The majority of business owners aren't, you know, living in big posh houses. You know, the majority of business owners make an okay living. They get by and they enjoy what they do, and that's okay. You know, I sometimes, when I'm chatting with university students and they're like, oh, I want to, you know, make money, so I want to start a business. If what you want to do in life is make money, go work at Goldman Sachs. Like, it's a different scorecard. And if you're working in, you know, the world of hedge funds and finance, the size of your bonus is quite a valid scorecard. There's not really much else to measure yourself against.
Yeah.
But I think if you do choose to go down the route of having your own business, you've got to figure out what really, really matters. Like, why are you doing this?
Because you notably started businesses, haven't you? And you're CEO of a couple, I think. And, you know, you do an awful lot already. So what was it that for you then that drove you down running your own business?
Well, I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be an airline pilot. That was the dream, right? And it's a really, really expensive career path.
It is.
So the only way I was going to be able to do it was I needed to find a bit of a side hustle just to make some money.
Yeah.
And so I just started doing kind of website development and just things like that involving graphic design and websites. And that's what turned into a business. So there was never a plan to become a business person. it just kind of happened. But I'm glad it did, because it introduced me to a whole different area of life that I never thought I'd be interested in.
Go on, explain that.
So, well, you know, it wasn't on my radar. I didn't particularly want to go into business. It's just there was a necessity that created this side hustle of building websites, and that just grew because it was exciting and it was fun, and we were able to, you know, I was able to create things, and then as the projects got bigger, you know, go and find other brilliant people and bring them in, and there was almost this kind of mission that I never realized that I had of kind of building things.
But you've notably come and, you know, talked about your anxiety certainly in early life, and then full-blown depression later on. I mean, it's interesting, the parallels with my journeys are pretty much exactly the same, actually, although I don't remember the anxiety quite as much, but then I was probably stupid and didn't realise what was going on. But
oh, no, nor did I.
But did you think, sorry, just before we explore that a bit more, did you think running your own business, you need to have a certain makeup, and that certain makeup has a tendency to be on, if I can put it this way, the spectrum of mental health?
I don't know. I don't think you need to have a certain makeup. I think you've got to want to do it, right? You've got to know why you're doing it, because it's hard and it's lonely and it's very, very stressful. And so I think there's an inevitability of anxiety in that world. And whether it's a little bit or a lot, I think if you're running your own thing, whatever that thing might be, it's a very anxious profession to be in.
Do you think that motivates you, though? Do you think the anxiety motivates you to deal with it and get better and understand
I think the anxiety almost becomes a bit... I think the anxiety gives you the adrenaline, in a way.
Yeah.
And if you enjoy that, then that's good, right? And I think, actually, all the studies around performance do show that a little bit of anxiety is actually brilliant performance, because it gives you just enough anxiety and dopamine where it keeps you on top of your game, and that's fine, you know. But I think the challenge is when it spirals, because it's a real knife edge there between like a healthy level of anxiety that makes you perform well versus, you know, a lot of anxiety that can become debilitating or challenging in other ways.
And it comes on you in different ways as well, doesn't it? So, I mean, for me, for example, it came on as I tend to catastrophize, if I can use that horrible word. So I'm fine, and then whoomph, I'll come down into a massive piece of, you know, black hole, whatever you want to call it, of depression. And then it takes me a while to get back out of it. Did you find any cycles like that, or...?
Definitely. The catastrophizing was how it manifested for me, for sure. And it was interesting because we didn't really have a language for it then. You know, I think it's really dangerous. Again, just my own view. I think it's really dangerous when people talk about a taboo with things like this, because there's a big difference between something being a genuine taboo and something just not really having a language in culture.
Yeah.
And I just feel like I never ever once in my life felt I couldn't talk about it. It's just we didn't really have a language for it. So you talked about everything around it apart from it, if you know what I mean. So, yeah,
but did you know, sorry to interrupt, but did you know that it was happening way back?
No, because the lack of a language meant I just thought I was, you know, feeling sad or feeling run down or just thinking about things too much and ruminating. And there was never the thing in the middle that connected all these symptoms together into this thing called anxiety. And the catastrophizing was, you know, about business decisions. There was a lot of it, weirdly. It's funny how these things pop out, right? A lot of it for me ended up being health anxiety.
Oh, really?
Ending up becoming like a huge kind of...
Physical health, you mean?
Hypochondriac,
right.
Which was a big challenge.
Well, you look very healthy now. I might say so.
Well, the thing is, there was never any health problems. This was the thing, right? I mean, the whole point of health anxiety is you're actually okay. It's just you get a headache and you'll somehow jump down the rabbit hole, convince yourself you have a brain tumor. And instead of it being, you know, we all do it. We'll all consult Dr. Google. But most people will consult Dr. Google and then just give themselves a bit of a check and go, I'm not a doctor, it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
But when you when you're catastrophizing, that doesn't suffice.
No. How do you get out of that? The bottom
therapy.
That was one of the things I was going to ask you. Have you had therapy?
Massive amount, and it was great. Because you know, you spend all these years in your life making the connections in your brain that make you think and behave a certain way, and you know, you need a professional to help unpick that and help to, you know, in the same way that if you suddenly start to get lots of repeated injuries when you're trying to run marathons or whatever, you need a physio. You can't just figure it out yourself. So it's the same principle. It's really interesting when somebody helps you understand why you think a certain way and then gives you an alternative approach, or tries lots and lots of different ways to just help you get over that stumbling block or get over that sort of cycle that's happening in your head. So I think the therapy side is really important.
How long have you been doing it?
Oh God, years, like decades. I don't tend to go as much nowadays, to be honest. But there was periods where I was going, you know, like weekly.
Yeah, because you see, I'm doing it weekly now. And I was complete resistant to it. And I used to say to myself that I don't need any help, you know, and that's part of the problems that I've got. I don't like accepting help because it then implies that I'm not good enough. Yeah, and I can do this on my own. And so I thought I could solve all of this problem on my own. But I then was convinced by my wife to, look, just give it a go. And
yeah,
so
exactly.
I have. And honestly, it has been transformational.
Yeah, and you'll know, and you know, you'll know when you need it. You'll know there's periods where you might, you know, need to go every week. There's periods where you might go once a month, and you've got to kind of allow yourself the space to figure it out yourself as well.
Yeah.
But it is really effective. And I think this is again where, you know, with everything in life, there's predatory elements. And I feel right now there's a lot of kind of predatory people out there who are trying to pitch in things like, you know, coaching as an alternative to real therapy. And a lot of people who are almost preying on people who really ought to see a counselor, a professional counselor or therapist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And trying to solve their problems with life coaching.
Yeah. Where are you on self-help books? Although I think I already know.
I think they're really important, but as an adjunct to an actual professional. Because the good thing is, I think a really good sort of science-based self-help book gives you a bit of additional background on, you know, how something like CBT might work or NLP might work, whatever it is. But I think on their own, they're kind of useless because,
it's a tick box as well, isn't it? Oh, I'll do this, this, and this, therefore I'm going to get
better.
Yeah,
it's a crutch.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people think that, you know, getting a healing crystal is an adjunct for getting an actual medical professional.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, because I don't pay any lip service to it. I do if there is some science behind it. And one of my favourites, and I've mentioned this a few times, is Dr. Michael Mosley. He does his Just One Thing, which I'm doing as many of those as I can. And I think as part of my cocktail of things that I can do, that's a key part of it.
Well, yeah, totally. Because, you know, for example, it might be that a therapist recommends a particular approach, like they might recommend CBT or they might recommend something else. And actually then a good science-based book which explains it, walks you through it, you know, that's really useful because it gives you an insight into what's happening and why you should stick with it and how effective it is. You know, same thing with something like mindfulness, for example, where there's lots of great books that really delve into it so you can understand it a bit more. What I have concerns with, and I've seen it through friends, is people will do everything they can other than see the person that can actually help them, who's a professional.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, I think in life we all want an easy route, right? We all want the easy fix. We all want to find the simplest possible, most attractive way to do something. And a lot of this other sort of predatory stuff sounds kind of fun. It's like, you know, let's go and sit in a forest and write journals all day. And
yeah, but if you get, as you probably know, if you've got mental health problems, that's the worst thing you can do with
other
people.
But it sounds fun, and it sounds like a good way of fixing something. And And I think that's the issue, because I think in the back of their minds, everyone knows that the minute you go into counselling or therapy, it's hard work.
Yeah, it is.
And it's supposed to be. That's okay, by the way. You know, it's kind of, if it wasn't hard, you know,
yeah, why bother if it's not hard work? Because you're actually going to, I mean, if any good counsellor will go and expose right back down to your basics. Mine went back to my childhood where, you know, I was at boarding school and bullied for being overweight and blah, blah, blah. And I suddenly realised, having gone to counselling over the last 2 years, that my issue goes all the way back to childhood. And actually, I've been experiencing it all throughout my life without realising it.
And this is what I mean, right? It's kind of, there's also an extent to which a lot of people will know, you know, in the back of your mind, you'll know how these things pick together. But it's also, there's not many people around who have the tools to challenge you, to make you really confront that stuff.
Mm.
And being really open, I don't think anyone should be confronting that kind of stuff when you're anxious without a professional doing it.
Because
it can just make it 100 times worse.
Yes, it can, because you go off in the wrong direction. But how, something you said a bit earlier about language, and we don't quite have the language to talk about these things, and particularly when you were going through your business breakfast and so on. But how can we actually create that language, and in particular in relation to business? Because I think the business environment is so, so difficult for people to admit that they've got a problem.
I think we definitely have more of a language on it now.
Yeah, I agree. Think people it is are improving. Much more, yeah. Yeah.
People are much more open and willing to have that conversation. And they do, you know. But it takes a little while to have real cultural change, right? And it takes a bit of time for people to adapt, because there's a layer of management and kind of, let's say, a different generation in business who aren't as used to it. But I really believe that you should really give everyone the benefit of the doubt and have those conversations and allow them to understand.
Yeah, it's giving
and allow them to ask silly questions,
yeah,
and allow them to learn their way through a situation.
Yeah.
Some of the problem is everyone's far too combative. So, you know, if somebody doesn't know, everyone starts pointing fingers. And so a lot of resistance is just because people are afraid of getting cancelled.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is boards of directors and senior management teams. And you were sort of alluding to it a little bit there, because you've got the younger generation coming through who have got the language and are, you know, are happy to speak about these things. But if you're ambitious, what do you do at work? Do you either put your hand up and say, I've got a problem, and therefore, through a duty of care, the organisation will not put pressure on you, putting it simply? Or do you hide behind that and not say anything and suffer?
Well, the organisation doesn't necessarily have a duty of care to not put pressure on you. The duty of care is to work with you on finding out an appropriate way of moving forward at that point in time.
Yes, I agree with that.
Right? So it's not always about giving someone less work. It's about figuring out, you know, maybe they need some time out. Maybe they need to take some leave, you know, whatever it might be.
Mm.
But it's also for people to realize that certain careers are really high pressured and they're going to be really stressful, and it's going to make you really anxious. And you've got to understand if you're okay with that, right? That's the really hard introspective career choice part of this discussion.
Because something you said a bit previously about a caricature of how you behave in business. And this is it, isn't it? This is how people are expected to behave, to be that hard-nosed businessman, competitive, you know, striving for the best and so on.
But here's the thing, you have to be. Like, you don't have to fake it, but you've got to be competitive, because, you know, we're in a competitive world. It's tough. You've got to be kind of hard-nosed, because you have a duty as a business, as a director in a business. It's not about being hard-nosed. It's about, most people that start businesses never read about the actual legal responsibilities of being a company director.
No.
You know, there's a lot. And you have to be hard-nosed, and you have to be really unemotional sometimes, but that's just your job, right? So a lot of this stuff is just, you've got to decide, is that okay for you? Is that okay in terms of what you want as a career? Because that is how it is. And what we can't do is sugarcoat it. And what we can't do is push a narrative out that says that everyone, irrespective of their makeup, will be okay in a very high performance career, because it just isn't for someone, and that's okay.
Yes, it is. Yes. But how, you see, one of the things that I experienced when I was at Superdry and I was finance director there was we tried to do a slightly early doors, but tried to do a lot down the organisation for people's well-being and so on, which some of which was successful and some of which was frankly rubbish. And then you've got external stakeholders are trying to deliver profits for, essentially, with an ESG agenda on the top of that. And the people in the board of directors, which is where my real interest comes from, obviously, because I've got personal experience of it, is the behaviour in the boardroom is frankly unacceptable sometimes. And it's bordering on bullying, you know, yeah, beating people up, throwing grenades.
And that cannot be allowed. Like, that's different. That is actual, you know, bullying and things like that don't have a place in any boardroom. But that's not... That's not something which is part of the job. That's people being, you know, it's, frankly, assholes.
Yeah, and playing their caricature about that's how they think they should behave. I mean, it's interesting that a lot of the people were, and I don't want to be ageist here, but they were the older generation, because the non-execs tend to be. They've been through their career. And the bad behaviour came from them.
Yeah, but guess what? Sunlight disinfects, right? And a lot of the time, the only reason that this kind of behaviour pervades is because no one's ever outed it or questioned it.
Yeah. Who should do that?
And there is an immense power to calling it out and saying that's not acceptable.
I think 10 years ago, I don't think that would have worked, because I did call it out once to our chairman, and particular person changed their behaviour the next meeting, and then the one after that, it reverted back to type.
10 years ago, we didn't have a way of outing it properly.
No, we didn't.
Right. Whereas now, people can just go to social and out it.
Yes, that's true.
We didn't have a. You know, you maybe could have gone to HR. You maybe could have had a one-to-one conversation, but there wasn't really an effective way for you to go outside that immediate decision-making structure to say this is not cool. Whereas now, I think most boardrooms are aware that the spotlight is on them, so they have to behave well. And where they don't, they should be called out on it.
Yeah, in my view, it's the chairman and the chief executive that has to call it out, because they're the senior guys in the room.
Mm.
How do you feel about that in terms of your own business?
What do you mean?
Well, if you experienced, because you're CEO, aren't you?
Yeah.
And if you experienced bad behaviour in your boardroom, what would you do?
You could call it out immediately.
And how would you then support that particular person?
Well, because you'd make it clear in the... So in that situation, you'd make it clear in the meeting straight away that wasn't acceptable. And then you'd have a one-to-one with them.
And is there
you can't do it in the shadows. If somebody behaves badly in a meeting, it is the chair's job or the CEO's job, depending on the board, to say, you know, for the record, that wasn't acceptable, and we'll discuss it offline.
Yeah, that, I mean, that would have been very refreshing if it happened in my day, but of course it didn't.
Yeah, but there was also, I think, we were still, even 10, 15 years ago, we were still coming out of an era where there was still a lot of deference to power, to the extent that everything was okay. You know, if people did behave badly, it's like, oh, okay, you know, just let it roll. Yeah,
that's just what she's like, yeah.
But it isn't okay. And that kind of bullying and pressure and, you know, whether it's sexist language or whatever it is, it has no place in a boardroom, because that's not the job of the board. The board is there as a governance and decision-making mechanism.
Yeah, yeah, but they don't behave like that, in my experience.
Then they're not fit to be on a board.
No, I agree. It's really that simple. No, I agree. Just coming back to entrepreneurs, though. I mean, because entrepreneurs they own their own businesses. They run them in their own style. The culture tends to be a reflection of their personality.
Yeah.
How does somebody then, around a boardroom there or a senior manager there, call out the entrepreneur?
Well, if they can't, then the business culture isn't working. You know, if you're in a situation where a business is so dependent on its founder, so let me rephrase. If the culture of a business is such that the founder's role trumps everything, then something's broken, right? So, for example, the same governance controls that apply to any director should apply to the founder. So any director in a business, if they want to make a big purchase, they've got to make a business case. They've got to justify it, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately it's the company's money, not yours, even if you're the main shareholder.
Yep.
And there's too many businesses where those controls don't exist. And so you end up with this kind of like, the founder is the principal and everything has to defer to them. And that just shows that your business hasn't grown up.
It does, but what, you know, how can you give some comfort to the person who's experiencing it, that to give them permission to actually say that?
This is going to sound really bad, but I don't think you need to wait for permission. You think you've just got to call it out when you see it.
But the consequences could be quite severe, couldn't they?
They could.
I mean, you could end up losing your job because the bloke says you're out, and you know, and then you're down the tribunal route, which is expensive and stressful.
Yeah,
and all of
you
those
could.
Sorts of things.
And that's a risk decision that each individual has to take.
And I guess that's what I'm sort of talking about a little bit, is because people will experience the behaviour, but they're too frightened because of their lifestyle and their job to actually say anything.
Yeah, but that's this is an individual moral decision that you've got to arrive at. Right, as to what is more important to you, and there's no real way of sugarcoating it. If you're not prepared to stand up for something, then what are you going to do?
In the same way, in
a more benign example, I do sometimes poke at my friends, and if we're having a political conversation and they've got views. If it turns out they didn't vote, I'm like, well, you don't really have a view then, do you? Because you couldn't even be bothered voting. And you've got to realize that from a moral standpoint, you as an individual have to make a decision about what's important to you, what matters to you, what are you prepared to stand up for, and what consequences are you prepared to bear? Because a lot of change requires brave people to stand up and take consequences.
Yes, it does. It does. But...
But the real caveat here is, if somebody decides that they don't want to be that person, I'm not judging them, because that's their decision. And they might have perfectly valid reasons for making that decision. But it's also really important to be aware that that is a decision.
Yeah, but then they end up being abused and suffering in silence, and you know, the risks are sometimes incredibly high, because you've got mortgage payments, you've got kids to feed and all of those, and houses to run and so on, that actually losing your job is catastrophic for these people.
Yeah, but I think people overestimate how easy it is, right? If you call out a CEO in a meeting and document it, you know, it's not that hard to boot some. It's not that easy to boot someone, especially now, especially when we have such fantastic protections in law.
Yeah, the wind is in the right direction, isn't it?
Completely.
Yeah.
You know, if we were in a board meeting, and, you know, I know you wouldn't, but let's say we were in a board meeting, and let's say that you said something out of turn and I was an employee and called you out and then wrote to you and said, just that you're aware, this is why I called you out. If all of a sudden 2 weeks later I get booted out, I'll probably get a year's salary and compensation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you were
right.
But there's a stress related to that, isn't there? And
there is.
The peace
but this is my point, right? Like, think of it this way. So, if you go to a country where protest is banned, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you decide to protest because you believe in something, there is a real significant risk attached to that exercise. And you as an individual have to decide if that's okay with you. And if it's not okay with you, you've got to realize that you've made a choice based on your circumstances, and that's okay.
It is, absolutely, that's okay.
But we've seen too many times in the public domain where company cultures have become extremely toxic because nobody called it out.
So how can I understand both sides of that. So it is a personal choice. So you can choose to go out, to call it out, or not to. And there are consequences for both of them. But for the people who don't want to, you know, it doesn't suddenly, they suffer at work in silence. They don't suddenly become a bad employee because they're, you know, they're not on top form or anything. They're still very capable people. Mm-hmm. So what can you do for to help those people? Because they, whether they exist or, well, they do exist. What can you do for those people just to help them get through their day and so on? What could an organization do?
Well, organizations have to think about culture at the front of everything, because people are coming, people have a choice to work for you, and they work for you, and it is your duty, therefore, to give them a good working culture, right? And it should have it, that should have a place at a board table, and you should be measuring it, and you should have a good, you know, good HR support. And that's not just a big business thing. Small businesses can get freelance.
Yeah. It's all businesses, yeah.
Exactly right. And if the company culture is flawed, and if somebody is sat there suffering away, my personal view, and it's just my view, is I think you need to consider why you're there.
The individual because, does. Yeah.
Because it's like being in a toxic relationship. People make a choice. You either stay in a toxic relationship because you're too scared to leave, or you leave.
Yes, it's.
But what you can't do is just sit there and be okay with it. There's no amount of mindfulness and therapy that can suddenly reverse a toxic situation such that you're just okay with it.
Yeah, I suppose we're all masters of our own destiny, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
To put a cliche on it, and therefore the choice is, I stay and keep quiet and do my mindfulness and therapy or whatever it is, not behind the scenes, but outside of work to help you get through it. Or you call it out, run the risk of getting fired, or you leave. Yeah.
And this is the thing, like, this isn't easy stuff. If a company has a horrible culture and you're suffering the consequences of that horrible culture, this isn't easy stuff.
No.
It takes a lot of courage to stand up for it. It takes courage to have the bravery to call it out. And it has consequences, you know. And you've got to decide as an individual, you know, what is the least worst option for you? Is it standing up to those consequences and trying to make a change? Or is it finding something else?
Sorry, I'm being quiet, which is bad news for radio because I'm thinking. But it's very difficult, though, sometimes, isn't it, to call something out at work when you are actually feeling pretty shit about yourself. So I want to just explore a little bit, perhaps mm-hmm. not now, but maybe later, about your business breakfast and the route, the journey that you went through to get to that point. And you've talked about being in a car park and, you know, looking at the... You know, it's just there. I could just leap over and it'd be fine. And it was relatively, it would have been relatively easy. I mean, I've been in exactly that same position, and not in a car park, actually. It was in the sea in Brazil. But I've lost my question now. I think we'll cut this bit out, actually. what was I talking about? I can't remember. I'm sorry. Oh, no. Oh, it's about your journey. Your journey. So what, when you are in that deep, dark depression, you don't think logically about calling it out. And then it just gets worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, but at the point at which you've got to that point, that's not the time to be calling stuff out, because at that point you're not well, right?
Yes, correct.
Like,
but then there's a
if you are a bit anxious about something or a bit miffed about something, that's the time to do it, right?
Yeah.
Or if you see something happen for the first time, you're like, that's not cool. That's the time to call it out. At the point at which your resilience is gone, and at the point at which you are in those really awful, dark places, the only thing that matters then is getting yourself well, right? That is the singular only thing that matters.
Yeah.
That's not the time to be making big, grand, sweeping, you know, statements and initiatives.
Do you think there's an oversensitivity on the individual who is suffering to think that something is, for example, bullying behavior rather than...
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I think when you're anxious, you read into everything. And I've done this myself. When you're in an anxious state of mind, somebody could just say something in a meeting and you're suddenly running down the road in your mind going, oh, that's because they don't like me or they don't think I'm doing a good job or something like this. But this is where resilience is the important word, right? We've got to be resilient to realize that everyone has their own circumstances. That other individual could be having a really bad day. That other individual could be really frustrated with something.
But you don't think like that, do you? You don't think, because it's all self-centered stuff when you're going through
that. But anxiety makes you really internalize everything. When you're anxious, everything's about you. Everything's aimed at you. Everything's because of something you did.
Yeah.
It's not, you don't have the resilience to go, oh, maybe it's because that person had a bit of a, you know, crappy day, or maybe they're going through something.
Yeah.
So you've got to de-emotionalize it and sometimes look at it as, you know, they tell you in therapy, look at it from above, like you're observing the situation and go, well, what really happened there?
Yeah.
And is it benign? Should I have a conversation? And if I have a conversation, how do I approach it? It might just be that I'd say, oh, I noticed this happened in a meeting, and now I'm probably just being a bit daft, but here's how it made me feel. Is everything okay? And that's actually a nice, sensitive way of having a conversation.
Yes, it is. I have done that. I have done that with people. And actually, they've been more upset than I was.
Like, again, a bit of a benign example. But imagine if we'd have had this conversation. And let's say if I was having a bit of a bad day today and I wasn't particularly, you know, engaged or responsive, you could sit there and go, is it because I'm just not doing a good job asking questions? Or if you're feeling that way, you could either pause for a moment or send an email later and go, I just noticed, you know, you seemed a bit distant in the conversation. Did I approach it okay? And usually most people would go, oh, don't worry, it's because of this, 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 and we're all good. But you've got to have enough resilience to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because and all conversations have consequences.
Yeah.
And somebody might turn around and say to you, actually, it's because I thought you were a bit spiky.
Yeah. But that's still sort of okay, isn't it? Because, I mean, I like feedback like that because I think, okay, right, so it was my fault. Although my wife says, quite often she says, well, don't think it's everything's your fault. You're not that powerful, which is so true because I don't have an influence over everything that happens in the world.
No, but at the same time, you have an influence over the part of the world that you're in, and you've got to be really alive to it. You've got to read people's body language in meetings. You've got to be able to just get a temperature of a situation and understand the right way to act and the right way to behave and the right language to use. But this is also where the tools of mindfulness are really important because they take you out of your head and park you in that moment. So you do start to notice things more.
Yeah. We're not quite running out of time yet, but we're nearly there. But I did want to come back to that journey that I was talking about. And you've obviously been talking about a lot. And can you just, I mean, you said it took you 10 years to say that you'd got depression. And the 10 years, what was, How did you feel? How did that react? How did it manifest itself?
So it was initially, you know, like we said before, it was initially just kind of catastrophizing a lot and ruminating, but then it gets worse and worse. And then the more you catastrophize, the more your resources are depleted. And so then you end up becoming depressed because you don't have much gas in the tank to fight with. And then when you have no real resources in the tank and you're still getting anxious, that's when you get into a really bad place because, you know, it's kind of inevitable that at some point your brain just goes, nah, what else are we going to do? You know, but it takes time. It's not like, you know, if somebody has a specific situation that was really bad, like the loss of a relative or something really awful happens, it's quite conceivable that you could immediately become depressed or be put into that state. Like, it's not beyond reason, right? But when it's the day-to-day stresses and strains of business, whatever it is, it can chip away at you over time. And if you don't have the resilience tools, which I didn't, that's what gradually tips you over to the point at which you realize you're over the edge before you even knew you were getting there.
Yeah, Yeah, and that's the hardest part to get back from, isn't it? If you can recognize those signals and those signs early, yeah, then you can actually do something, yeah, about it.
Yeah. Like a little, again, a little silly example. It's recognizing the little twinges mean you should do a bit. Like, so I had a slip disc a couple of years ago from when I was running, and you know, part of it was me not listening to the fact that those little lower back twinges mean I should have been doing more core strength and, you know, getting more resilient.
Yeah.
And so sometimes when it comes to our mental health, we do the same. We don't listen to those patterns of needing to self-medicate or feeling anxious or feeling down. And we don't sort of see that as a pattern. We think of it as too situational. I had a painful back because, oh, maybe I just didn't sit well that day or sleep well that day. But actually that pattern builds, and it's because your muscles are weak.
Yeah. Well, if you think about any professional sportsman or woman for that matter, you know, they do, what, 95, 99% of their work outside whatever they compete in terms
Completely
of training,
right,
and core strength and all of those sorts of things, that you have to almost work on these things all the time. Are you running out of time, by the way, Vikas? Are you running out of time?
No. Okay. It's fine. I literally, very bizarrely, I've got my laptop stands here, and I just banged my arm against it, and I was checking I hadn't cut myself.
You'll have a slipped elbow.
You have to work on these things all the time, right? In the same way that, like, I used to be really overweight as a youngster as well, and you know, one of the things you realize as part of the fitness journey is it doesn't stop. You've got to train every day. You've got to do strength training, and you've got to get into the discipline of doing it, because that's how you're going to live longer and be healthier.
Yeah, isn't that hard though? Because I find
it's really hard.
Yeah, the discipline
until it isn't, right? It's really hard.
I agree. But they're not New Year's resolutions, are they? They're not.
No.
I'm January the 1st. Right, I'm going to do this year. And by the 15th, you've forgotten the lot.
No, exactly. But this stuff is hard. It was really hard to get fit. It's really hard to change your diet. It's really hard to do all those things until it isn't.
Yeah.
Right?
And then
you get to the point where you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And so it's the same with mental health. It's really hard doing mindfulness. It's really hard doing all these things. It sucks. It's tough. But then, if you keep the discipline up and just be kind to yourself, like, don't expect to be able to sit down today and do a half an hour mindfulness session. I literally started by doing like a minute.
Yeah, I do lots of 2 minute sessions actually.
Yeah,
I've got it on my phone, you know, my watch.
But the research shows that that's just as effective.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is what I mean. Like, you've got to be really compassionate with yourself. And you know, we started this conversation with that question of, are you good enough? And particularly with things like mindfulness and any resilience tools, people jump in and go, right, I ought to be able to do this. But then you're not going to be able to do that. Like, you can't take somebody who's never run a marathon and is quite sedentary. Yeah. You can't just get them to go run a marathon. They've got to gradually do 1K, 2K, 5K, 10K. You know, you've got to build up.
It's like people throw themselves into it, don't they? Because they think, oh yeah, this is going to work for me because of XYZ, you know, the scientists
said
this.
So you've got to be kind to yourself and give yourself like a little daily challenge. Like, it might be, oh, I'll do a minute of mindfulness every day this week. And then next week I might do 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But that's how a discipline starts, because before you know it, you know, you're a year in and you're quite able to do 20 minutes.
And you're probably missing it as well if you don't do it. Because I talked about Michael Mosley and his Just One Thing, right? It's a Radio 4 podcast. And I do probably 10, 15 of those a day. I mean, they're really, really simple, like eat an apple, you know, drink water. One of the best ones is choose wine, actually, which I thoroughly enjoy. But but now I actually miss not doing them. And I feel guilty, for God's sake, for not having my apple every day.
Good.
I know, it is great, because it's now part of my lifestyle. And it's just,
this is the thing. Habits, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter how complex you are, habits can be built and habits can be broken. And that's one of the things you learn in therapy, right? And half the time, the reason we catastrophize is because we're in the habit of doing it.
Yeah.
And And that's exactly the thing you have to break. But like any habit, it takes a bit of effort to say no to that next coffee or no to the cake or whatever. You've got to get into the habit of doing it.
Because I go into the basket box and I open it up and I'll look at them and I'll say, no, I'm not going to do that. So I put the lid back on. I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, I'd have probably had three and thought, oh, well, I'll just treat myself. But actually now it's almost got to the point where I don't want them. Let alone saying, having to say
and
no.
And that's when you know the habit's broken.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I hear that a lot with friends who have been smokers and they go through that whole process.
Yeah.
And there's a long period of time where they have to almost have a conversation with themselves and go, no, I will not have it. And then, you know, think of it as a reward, like, great, good job, I said no. And then at some point you just notice that you didn't want one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's the same with anything, right? With anything around anxiety or the way we think or the way we approach things or our resilience. These are all habits that anyone can build.
We stopped having takeaways. We used to have a takeaway every Friday night, a curry, which was absolutely lovely, and I really enjoyed it. And we stopped. We just cut them back, and I actually gave up drinking alcohol at home as well. I didn't drink it when I was going out, but surprisingly, that was really easy to do. And now if everybody thinks, well, should we have a takeaway? And I'm thinking, well, no, I might have a bowl of cereal or a salad or something like that. And I feel so much better because of it.
Yeah.
But then you must treat yourself occasionally, mustn't you?
Oh, completely. But the thing you said there, which is really important, is you feel better. And that's the bit which takes a bit of time. But, you know, I feel a lot better being in better shape than not being in better shape.
Yeah,
because you've got more energy, you feel better in yourself, but it takes a bit of time to get there. And this is what I mean, right? There's no quick fixes to any of this.
No,
you can't go on a 5-day journaling workshop and cure depression.
No, it's taken me 5 years to get to this point.
It takes a long, long time. Yeah. And the work's never done. You know, you know, I went from going to therapy once a week to just going now and again.
Yeah, I'm on the borderline of doing that, actually. But I think I'm still going to keep going once a week.
Yeah, it might be that you then, like, I then went from once a week to every other week and then see how I get on. And then maybe once every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
See how I get on.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I'm quite there yet, actually.
Yeah, it happens when it happens.
Yeah. Look. Vikas, I'm sorry, I'm being told I have to wrap this up, but that's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I think we covered some really interesting ground, and, you know, and for what it's worth, I would never have believed it was your first one, because that was really great fun.
Well, thank you very much. I'm much appreciated. And clearly it's not your first, because I know you've done loads of them.
Yeah, but rarely am I on this side of an interview.
Oh, good. Oh, well, that's
I do
right,
lots
then.
Of interviewing.
Yeah.
But, you know, nowadays, when I was earlier in career, I used to do lots of interviews when I was kind of more interesting, inverted commas. But nowadays, I'm normally the one, let's say, asking the questions in an interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it is still a bit nerve-wracking being on this side of it. But no, I really enjoyed that.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks again. It's the first one of Just Not Good Enough. So, well, we'll wait and see when it gets broadcast out. Great. Lovely to meet you anyway. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.